Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Listeners, and welcome to the Dynamic Goat Show on here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm with Peter King and my brother in the martial arts and fellow co-host, Bob Steele. Today, how are you?
I'm doing well tonight. Beautiful night, raining in Southern California this weekend, but it's actually raining
over there.
It was. Yeah, look who I'm talking to about rain. Somebody in Seattle, where it's raining more than it's sunny. I'm really looking forward. We got a great guest tonight. Great forum shows. Next week, I'm really excited about next week. I've never seen the kind of show that we're going to have next week done, and I'm really excited.
You know, I've seen, like, and for our listeners that haven't seen our upcoming notices on our upcoming shows, next Sunday we're going to have a Rant, Rave, and Rap show. That's the name of our show, Rant, Rave, and Rap. And you can call in and talk about anything at all. I mean, well, save for politics and religion, because, I'm sorry, there's so many shows out there where you can call in and be the armchair politician or the religion police. So, you know, if you want to go check that out, then, you know, call those shows. But you can, you know, if you have something to talk about that you know, you want to complain about that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the religion or politics, you know, please call in. And it's not only complaining. You can call in and give a shout out, give some raves, or even if you have any announcements or events that you want to tell us about, let us know. So it's a talk about anything type of day. So it's people next week. So our number here is 347-677-0699. So anytime tonight, feel free to call in if you want to speak with us or tonight's guest. So with that said, let's go ahead and get rolling with our news of the week and then getting to our guest interview. But before we do that, Sipu Bob, would you do the honors in introducing our special guest?
Absolutely. Well, I took my son Brandon to Sensei Chris Damien in 2008 to do a little training, because Sensei Chris teaches at a park and rec in Burbank. Mm-hmm. And his wife thought I was nuts. Because I was just inducted into the Masters Hall of Fame. And I happened to mention this. And she looked at me and goes, and you can just see it in her face. It was like, yeah, right, whatever. but it was great. So what did I do the next year? I inducted Sensei K into the Masters Hall of Fame. So I'd like to introduce Sensei Chris Kadanian out of Burbank. Him and I have known each other a while. We've taught at the same seminars. Sensei K, how are you doing this evening?
Doing well, Sifu. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. We're going to have a great time.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're going to have a blast. So, again, listeners, our number is 357-677-0699. You can call in at any time. We're going to go ahead and do our news and announcements of the week before we get into the interview, but feel free to call in any time. You might be on hold for a little bit, but rest assured I'll get to you. So let's go ahead and get started with the news and announcements. I want to start off with one health story that I got off of CNN.com. And I'm just going to go ahead and read it off of the news release here. This is about more teens turning to muscle-enhancing products, and that most teens may not realize yet the dangers of steroids and other muscle-enhancing products. Now, I found this pretty interesting because although I knew that there are a lot of preteens and teens out there that want to be stronger for whatever sport they play in junior high or middle school or high school, college or whatever. I didn't know that the percentages were this big, but let me go ahead and read this. Dr. Nicholas Fletcher, an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at Emory University School of Medicine, says he definitely sees kids working toward increasing their body mass and overall strength. Now, I found that kind of weird because I knew that kids wanted to get stronger and better at their sport, but not necessarily body mass like bodybuilders. So while he says he hasn't found muscle-enhancing products as an issue in his practice, he does say that he does find kids trying to be like their athletic idols. So Dr. Fletcher says, as their idols have increased in size, they are continually pushed to get stronger, bigger, and faster. And that has a trickle-down effect to the kids. Researchers have looked at a diverse group of about 3,000 teams. So I guess this was a study. 3,000 teams who were attending a urban middle or high school in the Minneapolis, St. Paul metropolitan area. And this was during the 2009-2010 school year. And of the study subjects, 46.8 were male and 53.2 were female. So there was a little more gals in this particular study. And the average age was about 14 years old. Now, according to this study, 35% of the boys reported using protein powders, 6% reported using actual steroids, and 2/3 reported changing their diet to increase muscle tone size. Now, for the girls, 21% of the girls reported using protein powders, 4.6% used steroids, and 5.5% used other muscle-enhancing substances. 12% of the boys and 6% of the girls said they've used three or more of these substances or diet or exercise behaviors. So I read that and I was like, wow, that's a lot more than I thought, that these kids were actually going out and doing steroids or drinking a lot of protein powders. And the percentage of the kids that were actually doing just exercise and just diet was considerably lower. So I thought that was kind of a worrisome percentage right there. And so Dr. Fletcher ends this his comments with, parents need to be aware of what to look for in their kids, especially if they notice a big change in exercise patterns. Dr. Fletcher says that parents should treat it the same way they would a body image disorder. So, yeah, wow, you know, for kids to, you know, at 14 years old, that's, for me, that's the youngest I've ever heard of, you know, kids using steroids. Have any of you two heard of kids any younger using steroids or muscle-enhancing products?
I've never heard of kids using it at all under the age of 18. It typically didn't become popular until they were in their 20s or 30s to build, you know, bulk and to build mass. Those are incredible numbers you just read off.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? And I think it's because, and I'm not trying to place blame anywhere, but there are a lot of the, what do they call it, entertainment athletics on TV right now with the big dudes, you know, and the $1 million, you know, sporting events and stuff like that. And, you know, and it's I must say it's eye candy and it's attractive to a lot of kids. Girls too. I've seen girls watching what's one of those entertainment sporting things, like professional wrestling, for example. It's a
right.
big thing.
Okay.
It's huge. And
sure.
The characters or the athletes in these, I shouldn't call them characters, they play characters on there as part of the entertainment, but the athletes on there, they're big, they're huge. And, you know, I don't put it past kids wanting to be like, you know, like their idols. And especially now that there's a lot more women wrestling in these, a lot of these professional wrestling things. So, But again, I'm not placing blame anywhere, and I don't blame the kids either. It's just I think the information does need to get out there that steroids suck.
Yes, absolutely.
And that they're bad for you. So, okay, so there's that health tip for the week. And, Bob, do you have any health news on your end?
No, not me. No, I've got some news later, but not on the health end.
Okay, cool. All right, well, let's go ahead and go right to our Facebook announcements. Now, for our listeners out there that are not yet members of the Dynamic Dojo radio show page, if you like this show, feel free to check out our group page on Facebook. All you got to do is search for Dynamic Dojo, and you'll find our group page. And if you have any announcements, any events whatsoever, book signings, whatever you have going on, go ahead and post them on there. And me and Sifu Bob check the group page every week, and we take notes on what's going on, and we announce them on the next show. So go ahead and put them on there, and we'll make sure that you get some airtime on your event. Okay, so on our group page, this particular news bit comes from Michael Matsuda of the Martial Arts History Museum, right there where you guys are in Burbank. Now, the Martial Arts History Museum, I didn't know there was one, and I'm going off the subject for just a little bit because I want to tell the listeners about my visit to Burbank when I was hanging out with Sifu Robert this year, a few months ago. I didn't even know there was a Martial Arts History Museum at all. And when I went to go visit Burbank and Sifu Bob to get ready for the Masters Hall of Fame, Sifu Bob goes, "Hey, you know, let's go check out the Martial Arts History Museum." And I'm like, "What? there's a Martial Arts History Museum?" And I'm like, "Okay, when are we going? Let's go." So we went, and it was amazing. A lot of great artifacts in there. A lot of great timeline information in there. And these are real artifacts that come from people's collections or from the masters themselves that are featured in these exhibits. So this is the real deal stuff. These aren't like, what do you call them? Not substitutes. These aren't fake artifacts or anything like that. These actually belong in private collections. So for any of the listeners out there that are ever in the Burbank area and want to check out the Martial Arts History Museum, just hit us up on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page and get some information, and we can get you going over there. So anyway, this news bit is from the president of the Martial Arts History Museum, Michael Matsuda. And this is what he says. He says, "Remember the great Jerry Fisher from the tournaments of the 80s and the champion Donnie Williams or Kung Fu pioneer Carl Totten? Remember Kung Fu pioneer Douglas Wong? How about the author of Fight Choreography by John Crane? What about the famous author Emil Farkas? Well, many of these amazing people will be featured at the Martial Arts History Museum, announcing, reading from, discussing, and signing their books at a book fest next Saturday, December 8th, noon to 6 p.m. So that's next Friday, isn't it? Oh, my goodness, it's soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will be there.
Right on. And for listeners, if you go there, you'll see host Sifu Bob over there. Look for Sifu Bob. And also, in addition to BookFest, they'll be having a few tables of vendors offering some great Christmas gifts and stuff. There's also going to be a variety of other authors and people there, including Alan Woodman from the East. I'm reading this wrong. Okay, Alan Woodman and the president of the Martial Arts History Museum, Michael Matsuda, will discuss his museum book. Now, this event is free. There's no charge to get in, folks. So it's a free event. So if you're in the Burbank area, go check it out. You're going to be seeing a lot of martial arts pioneers there, martial arts celebrities. I'm sure if these authors are going to be there, you might see some martial arts celebrities there. So go check it out. If you got a book from any one of these luminaries, go get them signed. Go hear about their books. It'll be fun. So, yeah, go check that out. All right. Yeah, that's pretty cool. So we're looking forward to hearing about that event on the next show after that from you, Sifu Bob. That'd be great.
Absolutely. I've got something from Ninth Dragon Martial Arts.
Oh, right.
next Friday, December 7th, they're having an improvised weapons self-defense seminar, which will be interesting because I really dig environmental self-defense, sort of like Jackie Chan with ashtrays or something just lying around.
Right.
This is in Dunn's Fries, Virginia, at 3733 Fettler, Fettler, Park Drive in Dunn's Fries, Virginia, 22025 the zip code. You can call and reserve your spot today at 703-981-2420, or you can email them at ndma@nightdragonma.com. And that sounds like a real cool event to go to.
Yeah,
it is. You can go check it out.
Yeah, if you're over there in, how do you say it, Dumfries? Dumfries?
D-U-M-F-R-I-E-S.
Yeah, if anyone out there knows how to say that, I'd be interested in knowing how to say it, because there's like two different ways I could say it. Dumfries? Dumfries?
Or Dumfries, absolutely.
Somebody correct us before we sound like idiots.
Too late.
Too late. I think so. It's too late. All right. And I'm looking at the announcement too, and I like this part. It says, if you can find it in your backpack, purse, or pocket, you can use it to save your life. That's awesome. So,
that
listeners, if you're in the Dumfries, whatever, I can't say the city. If you're in that area, Virginia, go check out Grandmaster Pereira's Improvised Weapons Seminar. All right. Weird news. We are at Weird News. Woohoo.
We are.
Well, I guess, sometimes I think the second we go on the air, we're just Weird News.
I'm glad you said that before I did.
All right. Now, I had to put this under Weird News because I couldn't really categorize it anywhere else. But it's not really weird, but more of a wake-up call. So this is about a guy that narrowly escapes abduction charges when he picks up his girlfriend's daughter. Right name, wrong daughter. So, this is coming from NBC10.com. I'm going to go ahead and read this off. Oh, my goodness. A man narrowly escaped abduction charges after he mistakenly picked up the wrong girl from a New Jersey school. Courtney Durer was waiting to be picked up by her mom's friend after school in Gloucester City, New Jersey, this past Tuesday. And at the same location, a man named Art Diener was supposed to pick up his friend's daughter, Courtney. But this other daughter, Courtney, her last name is Fetters. So we've got Courtney Durer and Courtney Fetters. Okay. So when Art Dean arrived, supposedly to pick up Courtney Fetters, he saw Courtney Durer, who looked a little bit like the girl he was told to pick up. So he called for her to come inside his vehicle. I told her, this is what Diener says, I told her I was looking for Courtney. And the girl said her name was Courtney. Now, Courtney says, this is later on, I got off the bus and he pulled up and he asked if there was a Courtney. I said, yeah, my name's Courtney. And from there, my crossing guard let me go and I went with him. And this is where it gets better. Not better, but this is where it gets funky. Now, Courtney Durer also knew that she was being picked up by her mom's friend. So she assumed that Art Diener was that friend. But the problem was that Diener was supposed to pick up 6-year-old Courtney Fetters, not 9-year-old Courtney Durer, who is in his car. So now the excuse that Diener has was that he hadn't seen Courtney Fetters in some weeks, and Courtney Fetters had recently got her hair cut. So he assumed that the Courtney Durer was the one that he was looking for. But this is what Diener says. My girlfriend called me and goes, where's Courtney? And this is Courtney Durer's mother, okay, the girl in Art's car. So Courtney Durr's mother inside Art's car gets a call from the friend that's supposed to pick up Courtney and goes, where is Courtney? And the mother goes, well, she's supposed to be at the bus stop waiting for you. And the friend goes, she ain't here. Where could she be? And then Diener, on the other hand, he's driving and he's starting to realize something isn't right because he was talking to the girl about her recent vacation. And Courtney Durr says, yeah, he was like, you weren't with Aunt Mary in Maine? And Courtney Durr says, no, I would have never been in Maine. I've never been to Maine. And that's when Diener said something was up. I know Courtney was in Maine for 2 weeks, says Diener, and I had to turn around and take her back. I had the wrong Courtney. The police, however, were already on his trail. They pulled over Diener and arrested him. However, the crossing guard, where he picked up Courtney Durr, noticed that Courtney Durr went inside a vehicle that she normally didn't go in. Fearing an abduction, she automatically recorded Diener's license number and called the police. And after the police asked them a few questions, the police realized it was just a mix-up and a confusion of identity, and they didn't file charges. In the end, Courtney Fetters was found safe and sound, and Courtney Durr was reunited with her mother. And the Courtney that was in Art's car, her mother, Pam Durr, says, I forgive them. They didn't know any better because they haven't seen her in a while. That was a lesson learned. However, Courtney Durr says, I'll always remember, don't go into someone's car when you don't know them. Now, while Art Diener had trouble recognizing the right Courtney, he tells NBC 10 that he will from now on always remember what she looks like now. I won't forget, said Diener. I'll take a picture. So, and again, that was from NBC10.com. And on the website that I got this clip, it's got a picture of these two girls. And they do look vaguely similar, although one is 3 years older. But they do, it's incredible. I'd probably mistake them too if I didn't know who I was looking for. If I was just going off of a picture, I would probably pick up the wrong girl too. So, yeah, can you?
I can't believe that.
Yeah, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, can you imagine? You're like, something's not right. This doesn't seem right. And then there are police sirens behind you, and you're like,
well, that like, sucks.
Yeah, and you're wondering what the heck's going on. So it's like, I can't even begin to be putting myself in that guy's shoes. So, anyhow, so there's my weird news for the week. Bob, I think you've got some weird news, don't you?
I do have some weird news. A few kids in Florida got a holiday gift that nobody would want. They found a couple live hand grenades in their backyard.
No way.
Yeah. The kids were playing in their backyard on Saturday when they found the first grenade, and they told a relative who called deputies, according to the Brandon Herald. The man who called the police told West TV that his grandson picked up one of the grenades and brought it to him. I would flip out.
The
children didn't realize what they had. They looked at it, and it was a grenade from World War II. The resident told the station, I figured it was one of those practice ones. Oh, yeah, like they have a lot of practice grenades in that part of the country. though they might be a hole in it, you know, where the gun powder, the powder would typically be. They drill a hole in it, so it's a dud.
Right.
And there wasn't a hole. So I took it outside, shut it down, and called 911. The Orange County Sheriff's Bomb Squad arrived at the scene and secured the area, even closing the main road for a mile before detonating the object, which left a 3 foot deep hole in the front yard of the man.
Oh, criminy.
of the man yard. Wow, that is a trip. That is, I would have just went nuts. Now, I'm going to move right on to Weird Lives. Now, I have to preface this, Sifu.
Okay.
Remember that these laws were put into place because there was a problem, just like you have a warning on your hairdryer, do not use in the bathtub, or McDonald's has a warning on the coffee cups, caution, hot. You're like, well, yeah, no kidding.
Right.
And now I just went down a list. These are all from Alabama, and so keep that in mind.
Okay.
Are we going to get called now? In Alabama, bear wrestling matches are prohibited.
Well, say that again.
Bear wrestling matches are prohibited.
Well, that sucks.
Another law, boogers may not be slicked into the wind. Who does this?
Wait. I got to move my headset. Hold on.
And this is just a weird law. In Alabama, it's illegal to play dominoes on Sunday.
Oh, well, you see, now that sucks. Wait a minute. Let's go back to the boogers not being flicked into the wind.
And you know that must have been a problem at one time.
I know, right? I mean, well, okay.
Hey, Deb, look at this one.
I mean, what were they? What kind of boogers were they flicking? Like buffalo boogers? I mean, I don't get it.
It's like weird.
Oh, boy. Oh. Oh, wait. I'm crying. Hold on. The boogers thing.
I knew that would get you.
All right. Alabama, if there's anyone listening from Alabama, really?
Yeah, please.
Really? That sure
it's like, please call.
I know, please call. If there's anyone listening anywhere in Alabama, please call. Because, you know, that beats our Washington law here where it's illegal to bring a bull or an aquarium on a bus because it might disturb the other passengers. So I thought that law was wild, but boogers flick into the wind. Okay. That's awesome. Thanks for those weird laws, Sifu Bob. I love it when Sifu Bob says weird law. I do. I love it because it's like I never know what's coming, and it's awesome. It's great. Oh my goodness. Okay. All right. Well, we are now at the trivia question of the week. Woo! I don't have a fanfare for the trivia question of the week, but I'll have one by next week. But now, let me explain to the listeners first what this whole trivia question of the week thing is. Now, for the trivia question of the week, we give the question, and if you are the first caller, not chat board person, not posting on Dynamic Dojo, but if you're the first caller with the correct answer, you win absolutely nothing. You win bragging rights. No, really, you win bragging rights that you got the trivia question of the week on the Dynamic Dojo radio show, and you get to be a co-host on an upcoming show with me and Sifu Bob. So that's how that goes. So, and now let's go to the trivia question of the week. What is the longest word that can be typed entirely by the left hand only? Again, what is the longest word that can be typed entirely only by the left hand? Only by the left hand. Third type of left hand. You know the right answer. Just call it 7677-0699. So, 347-677-0699. Chat board does not count. Neither does the Dynamic Dojo page count. You must be the first caller to win bragging rights and to be a co-host with me and Sifu Bob on an upcoming show. So,
and you had to mention that thing about I'm disqualified, right?
Yep. You're disqualified. Fortunately, Master Damien is disqualified because he is considered a co-host today. But if there are any listeners out there that want to be a co-host, go ahead and call in. Now, you know, if you don't call in today, I won't be completely hurt. Yes, I will, but that's beside the point. But you can still post your answers on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page in case you do happen to know the answer. You know, hey, educational too, right?
All right. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, let's do this real quick since unless you've got any more news, Sifu Bob, do you have any more news?
No, I'm good. Let's
All right.
Go on.
All right. Well, let's just take a quick 1 minute break for just a couple of PSAs, and then we'll be back for the interview with Master Chris Kadamian. So let's just take a second for a word from the Ad Council.
Some statistics are surprising. Some are unbelievable. And some are simply unacceptable. Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. Nearly 30%. And that's the average. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone, not just parents, but friends and neighbors and family members, to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them. Challenge them, push them a little, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through. Because this is one statistic we simply can't afford to ignore.
You can do your part by going to boostup.org and sending an email, a text message, or even a wake-up call to a student at risk of dropping out. Go to boostup.org and provide the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
This is Healthcare 411, information for better health. About 17% of U.S. kids and teens are obese. ARC research shows weight management programs such as those offered by some schools or healthcare centers can help. But becoming healthier takes commitment. ARC director Dr. Carolyn Clancy explains.
There is no clear-cut solution that works for everyone, but it does help to have the whole family adopt healthy habits early to reduce the risks of any member becoming obese. All parents should continue to encourage their kids to adopt healthy habits, such as getting daily exercise and eating a healthy diet. Be a good example to them. It's one of the greatest preventive health gifts you can give to your family.
Order a free DVD from ARC, available online at ahrq.gov/child/dvdobesity.htm. Healthcare 411 is produced by ARC, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Deborah James for Healthcare 411.
And now, on with the show.
Welcome back, listeners. If you're just tuning in, you just tuned in to the Dynamic Dojo radio show with Rashida and Robert. Our call-in number here is 347-677-0699. And our special guest today is Master Chris Kadamian. Master Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for joining us for the weird news and stuff like that.
I was having so much fun listening to it, I forgot I'm actually on also.
Yeah, I was wondering, I'm like, is Master Kadamian still there? That was pretty fun. All right. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to go ahead and start off with the usual textbook question that everybody asks any guest on a martial art interview show. So would it be possible if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your beginnings in martial arts, when you started and all that good stuff?
Sure. You know, I was kind of born into it, is the way I look at it. My grandfather was very big into wrestling, a little bit of boxing also, but he was a catch wrestler. Nothing professional, but, you know, I remember before I can even, walk, just growing up, he used to just always wrestle with me, put me in different holds, you know, let me struggle to get out of it, so... You know, I was always I was always exposed to that, and I remember as I got older, he would have different people over at the house just to put a little match on, and at times he'd have five people coming at him at the same time. You know, just to, yeah, it was kind of exciting. So, you know, as a kid, you get excited and you want to jump in there also, and always told me these great stories also of his journeys and some of the fights he used to get into. Mm-hmm. And then my dad used to work for the airline industry, so we ended up moving around quite a bit from country to country. And so I remember when I was about probably 5 years old or so, seeing my first Bruce Lee movie, which was Enter the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so, you know, like many people. And one of the things that caught my attention was the kicking and the weapons. And I hadn't, you know, seen anything like that. So, and it wasn't really even about the fighting. It was just the beauty of it. You know, something was just attractive to me. So, you know, I talked to my dad and, you know, said, hey, you know, can I learn how to do this stuff also? So as we moved around, in those days, you didn't have the luxury of, you know, picking your martial art or teacher or, you know, mm-hmm. the type of school you want to go to. They were far and few, and they didn't teach kids, you know, at a very, very young age. You know, I think mm-hmm. a lot of them in those days, it probably had to be 9 or 10 at least to start. So, you know, you took what you can get. And
right.
But, you know, subsequently I ended up, you know, working with some good instructors. As a kid, you don't know, you know, you don't know how good your instructor is. You don't know what the style's about. You know, you're just there because, you know, you're having fun, you're learning. Later, as you mm-hmm. grow up and take more interest, you look back and, you know, you think, wow, you know, I trained with this person or I learned this. It's pretty cool. So I started with wrestling, did a little bit of boxing after that. Then my first, you know, Asian martial art was Shotokan karate. You know, they were the most prominent all over the world, where, you know, wherever you went.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into Kung Fu here, actually, in Glendale, right here in Southern California. And the instructor there was Buck Sam Kong.
Oh,
and
he's out of, okay.
Yeah, he's out of Hawaii. Of course, I didn't know who he was, you know, at the time. But I really enjoyed it there, and I was there for many years. And then he actually ended up moving back for a while. So I got back into karate and then did some taekwondo after that because I wanted to compete, you know, a little bit more, and taekwondo was big on that.
Mm-hmm.
And with taekwondo, I picked up a little bit of judo, again, just from a competition perspective. And then about in high school, I had a science class, and the teacher, the first day of class, shows a film, and, you know, in those days it was exciting, you know, you get to see a film instead of do classwork.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And it got better from there because it was a black and white martial arts film. You know, and it was actually a little footage of some martial art demonstrations. And it was a, you know, the main character was this, you know, little Japanese guy, bald Japanese guy, short, that was throwing people around in a way I hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So so he says, you know, he says, this is Aikido. And, you know, so if anybody's interested, he said, I have a little Aikido club that I teach after school. Well, I used to play football, so it was a little bit difficult to get away, but whenever I could, I dropped in there one time, and, you know, it was different than anything else I had done. I tried to relate it to, you know, other things, but it seemed like it shouldn't work, but, you know, it was working for him, you know, so I took a lot of interest in it and wanted to learn it, and I did. I went on and off for my 3 years in high school. And then after high school, well, in the meantime, I found out he was the head instructor at the Japanese Cultural Center in Pasadena for Aikido. Yeah, his name was Gene Anderson. And so I ended up over there, and I trained there for for a while. And then, you know, through my job situation, I got into law enforcement work. So through that, I ended up working with the Burbank PD. I didn't work for the Burbank PD, but I was helping them with some of their arrest and control techniques, and went a lot of ride-alongs with them just to assess different situations and, you know, see what I, you know, how I can advise them. And I met a guy there, one of the officers, that ended up being a good martial artist also, and he practiced an art called Hapkido. So so we started training, and I realized it's a lot like Aikido, but a little bit more, you know, aggressive. So we did that for a while, and anyway, long story short, about 10 years ago, I met my current instructor, who's Tadashi Yamashita, and I've been with him since then. Mm-hmm. And so I consider him, you know, my main instructor. So my grandfather was probably my biggest influence for, you know, getting started. And, you know, Grandmaster Yamashita, probably the, you know, most influential instructor I've had for, you know, any length of time. So that's kind of it. You know, as far as the arts, you know, karate has always been there. Wrestling, Hapkido, Aikido, Kung Fu. So that's it in a nutshell.
Right on. Now, what was it? Just out of curiosity.
Cool.
I know, isn't that cool? It's that's a wonderful myriad of arts background to draw from. And just out of curiosity, what was it like training under Grandmaster Yamashita? I mean, he's like one of the Kobudo legends. You know, he was a legend when I was, you know, coming up in the 1980s. I was a kid.
Yeah.
It picked up, I forgot which book it was, but it had Grandmaster Yamashita in it, and he was demonstrating nunchaku and all sorts of stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, he's great.
Yeah, he's,
you know?
I see him every other Friday. We train one on one. Yeah, for the past 10 years or so, I've been doing that. We've become good friends. He's a good mentor and a good advisor. He's phenomenal. He's for the level of expertise that he has and the knowledge and the experience. He's a very low-profile person, so
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, if he was out there, you know, a little bit more, he'd be all over the news, at least in the martial arts world on a regular basis. Yeah, I got some great stories with him. I mean, I think I had first seen him, of course, again, you don't know who these people are growing up, but I think I first saw him in the octagon. And that's the first time I saw somebody use commas. And, you know, I hadn't come across that weapon. You know, even though you train in karate all over the world, Kobudo was not as common. So I thought they were just menacing-looking weapons. And I thought, well, I hope I never meet a guy like this in a dark alley. So years later, one of my friends is also an instructor now in Virginia. He calls me up. He goes, I know you're looking for somebody at a higher level, you know, to train with. I got the guy for you. He says, but I got to do a formal introduction. Mm-hmm. So, he tells me the name, and I didn't know who he was. I didn't put two and two together at the time. So he says, I'm going to be out in L.A. He says, he lives in L.A. He says, why don't I arrange to do a seminar? He says, because he's going to want to see you in action before, you know, he even considers, you know, training you. So I said, okay, you know, I'm kind of a hands-on person, too. I like to be on the floor a lot. So we put on a seminar, and he walks in. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I know who this guy is. You know, actually, it was kind of a funny story, behind that, too, because this happened the second time, so I'll finish up. So he comes in, and I said, okay, I know who this guy is. So we our first seminar happened to be a sword seminar. Why we picked that initially, I have no idea, but
why not comma?
Yeah.
Right.
And he did, you know, he has his own system. he calls Sui Kan Do. So he did a little demonstration of that, and it was just amazing, you know, the speed in which he moves. You know, it's just phenomenal. It was like firecrackers going off.
Mm-hmm.
So afterwards, and I didn't really get a chance, you know, to talk to him afterwards. You know, my friend formally introduced him to me, and so I said, you know, with your permission, if it's okay, I said I'd like to start training. So he gives me his number. He says, call me. You know, traditional Japanese, they never accept you right away. So,
right.
So you kind of have to keep trying. So I give him a call, and he says, okay, you know, come at this time. And so I go over there, and he says, so what do you want to work on? I said, well, you know, I can use some more guidance on my sword technique, you know. So
mm-hmm.
we start doing that, and, you know, after the second time, you know, I thought I'd ask him, you know, so what do you think, you know, your assessment on, you know, where I'm at? So he looks at me and he says, you know too much, you know, for your age. So I thought in my mind, like, isn't that a good thing? Like, was that a compliment?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, you know.
Yeah.
And he didn't say that after that. It wasn't actually until a few years later that we were talking about that. And he wanted me to give me a chance to understand what he said before we had a further conversation. You know, what he was basically trying to say is I had gathered a lot of knowledge, but my level of understanding of, you know, what the knowledge actually meant, you know, hadn't caught up. So, you know, from his perspective, it's better if you know less, but be very good at it. So, of course, that had a lot of influence on me. So the second time we're having a seminar, now I get to set it up and everything. And, so I tell him where it is. He's only been out there one time to the studio in Burbank. So I assumed he knew, you know, how to get there. And he's a stickler on being on time. In fact, you know, if you're going to start on the hour, he shows up half an hour early at least. You know, so you kind of have to expect that. So I think we're starting at 10 in the morning or something, and everybody's there. There's a lot of people in the room, and everybody's excited now. We've opened it up to, you know, all the students at this point, and they're excited to meet him. So he's not there, 9:45, and I'm thinking, should I call him, you know, on his cell phone? I thought maybe, you know, it would be, he would, you know, be insulted because it's like, you know, why would you think, you know, I don't know how to get there, you know, type of thing. We're still kind of pulling each other out, you know. And so 10 o'clock, he's not there. You know, 10:10, I'm like, man, maybe he got into an accident or something. So I call him, and he picks up, and he's pissed.
Uh-oh.
And he goes, why didn't you call me sooner? I said, well, Sensei, I'm not sure, you know. He says, he goes, where's your place? He goes, I'm lost. So he's upset because, you know, now I made him look bad, you know, for being late. So it was, you know, the adventure kind of started from there because he would never directly communicate, you know, what he wants or, you know, you kind of have to read between the lines and you're expected to understand certain things. So, you know, and of course he's translating everything from Japanese. So he'll say, you know, slide after punch, you know, like as far as, you know, moving forward. Well, I'm thinking that doesn't sound right. You know, aren't you supposed to move first, stop, then punch? You know, but he's saying, you know, slide and afterwards punch, you know. So it's a little bit different. But, yeah, a lot of interesting, you know, things with him. He's definitely a character. But he's just phenomenal. And I think his upbringing is a little bit different, too, because this is all he's ever done. You know, he did acting as kind of a side thing, as an offshoot of martial arts. But, you know, he's never had any type of other job in his whole life. You know, he's just done the martial arts and, you know, I can't say enough about him. I always feel fortunate to have somebody like him, you know, that I can train with and learn from and be mentored, because it's just good to have that. You know, it keeps me humble too. every time I think I've gotten good at something, you know, the things he does with nunchucks, I can't even describe. You have to, you know, he flicks that thing like it's just floating in air. Mm-hmm. So I've never seen anybody use it that way. He used to knock cherries out of people's mouths and, you know, cut the watermelon, you know, with a sword on stomachs. And so I asked him one time, I said, so what's the secret, you know, to doing those things? And he says, no secret. He says, you just have to remember exactly when to stop. And I think that scared me more than anything else, you know. Before I felt halfway comfortable, because I thought there's some secret, you know, you're never going to get hit with it. But
right.
It's
yeah.
just so easy to make a mistake. But, he's an interesting character. I mean, I can just go on about him, but.
That's awesome.
Oh,
yeah, go ahead, Bob.
You know, it's funny, like all of us, you know, you grew up watching Bruce Lee as well. I have a funny bit of, actually, it's a little bit of trivia. Sifu, do you know who Yip Man is?
Do I?
Yip Man,
yeah.
Yip Man, of course, was Bruce Lee's teacher. Today, I saw it on Facebook, today is the 40th anniversary of his passing.
Oh, wow. It's been that long already.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, he passed about 6 months prior to Bruce.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. That was 73?
He died in 72. Bruce was 73.
Oh, okay, right, okay.
And Bruce actually got a lot of flack because he didn't go to China to attend Yip Man's funeral.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I do have a couple questions for you, Sensei. Growing up in the martial arts, what challenges did you face starting martial arts in the 1970s that wouldn't be around today due to, continued on next page. Oh, that's not part of the question, though. So let me start that one again. What challenges did you face starting martial arts in the 1970s that wouldn't be around today due to the fact that the schools weren't as, you didn't find them in every block like you do today?
Mm-hmm.
What challenges did you face growing up starting that early?
Because I started at an early age, there were probably more challenges than I was actually aware of. I think, you know, what you remember are the things that you personally experienced and realized that it's happening, you know, as a child. I think if I had started as an adult, I probably, you know, would have been aware of more things that were going on. But, I mean, if I have to pick something, I would say, in those days, again, the challenge was is you couldn't pick and choose. A lot of the instructors, at least that I came across, were of Asian descent. So they were really, for me, predominantly either Japanese or Chinese. And for different reasons, because of cultural reasons, you know, they weren't as open to, you know, non-Asians training them to higher levels. So, you know, maybe they accepted you as a student, you know, at the lower levels, but I realized, you know, after a while that, you know, they were, the Asian kids were being taught, you know, some things that we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you asked, you know, you'd be told, well, you'll learn them eventually or something, but, you know, the time never really comes. And then the other challenge was, you know, they didn't really speak English. So it was, of course, in martial arts, you can kind of get away with that. But, you know, after a while, you'd learn at least what the moves are called and what the direction is and just kind of, you know, fill in the blanks yourself. Where I think nowadays, you know, the culture has changed where, you know, regardless of the descent somebody's from, they're much more open and willing to work with just about anybody. I think the more traditional people probably, you know, want to assess your character more than you know, ethnic background or, you know, mm-hmm. race or, you know, cultural thing, which is okay, you know, which is good thing to do. So I think like a lot of things in our society, the people starting off, especially the younger ones today, it's, you know, they kind of take it for granted because it's so readily available and there's a lot of good instruction around. There's a lot of good material around. You know, the other thing is probably structure. You know, when I was growing up and we went to class and the instructor showed up and said, this is what we're working on today. And, you know, the next day it could be something completely different. So there wasn't, you know, a set curriculum per se, you know, as far as the training. So, and you kind of had to, you know, piece things together yourself where now, you know, I think a lot of places, at least, you know, maybe the more mainstream ones, have a pretty good curriculum. So you kind of know, okay, this is what you need for the first level, second level. There's good training that's in place that has some continuity that relates back to, you know, your katas, your forms, and so forth. So, you know, just really the availability and the openness of the instructors and the structure, I think, is the biggest challenge we had in those days that is less so today. I'm sure it still exists, but, you know, it's a lot less obvious if it does.
Well, it does then say, only, well, this is quite a few years ago, there was a martial arts video store in Wilmington that I used to go to, and the proprietor was a Pakwa master, and he told us on his father's deathbed, his father made him promise not to teach Caucasians.
Wow.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. You know, I mean, with my experience, those challenges were there, but I tell you, what I found was pretty much without exception with everybody I've trained with, regardless of how their attitude was, you know, starting out, they all did open up eventually, you know, for students that stuck around, that worked hard and, you know, that showed loyalty and commitment to what they wanted to do. So I think after a while, you know, the lines blur, you know, if the student is, you know, really loyal and hardworking, which ended up, in my case, that's what it was. You know, by the time I got to the higher levels, you know, a lot of the resistance had dwindled, you know, because there was trust built and there was, you know, understanding. And so I was always very fortunate. And, you know, sometimes they had kids about my age, too. So we'd end up being training partners or friends. And so that was kind of a natural extension of them accepting you. So, but I know it wasn't the case for, you know, some other people. So, but I think a lot of instructors, again, regardless of what their initial disposition is, you know, do open up and soften up as far as, you know, any prejudices or reservation that they may have for students that really become part of the family, you know, after training for so long.
Mm-hmm. Right on.
Now, funny, you mentioned a communication barrier, Sensei. I used to teach at Swordplay Fencing Studio when they were on Magnolia, almost 25 years ago when they first started. And
they
I got
moved,
a contract.
You know,
I'm sorry, what?
They just recently moved.
They're
out of San Fernando now.
Right, right.
Victory, and, yes, you're right, it's Victory.
And I get a call from a production company that they do radio shows like Europe, and the winner of these radio contests would come to the United States and do whatever movie they were related to, do what was within that movie. This is upset. In my case, they were doing martial arts. Like I did one for Lethal Weapon 2, I believe. And the reason I got the gig is the first person that they called was Bok Sam Kong. They couldn't understand a word he said.
Yeah, yeah, that's funny.
You know, and so I know you teach weapons. I know you teach bow, Joe, stick. What weapons do you teach? And tell me a little of the origin, you know, where the sticks came from in your, because I'm a Kali practitioner. Sifu Rasita's Dose Parsis Supreme practitioner. Where did your weapons come from in your training?
Well, before Sensei Yamashita, I predominantly practiced, when I was in Kung Fu, I did broadsword. And then I picked up the katana after that, and then the bow. So really, the two main weapons that I practiced was the bow, which is the six-foot staff, and the katana. And, the teachers I learned it from, I don't think that was their main thing. I think that was, you know, maybe they had some training in it and, a little bit of background. And, you know, maybe they had more of a background, but it wasn't a big part of the curriculum. It was kind of an extra that you did it at higher levels. Of course, I did it because it was just fun. every kid wanted to do weapons, you know, so, you see it in movies and to actually hold one and do it right. With what I teach now is, a lot of the Okinawan Kobudo weapons. So in our curriculum right now, we have the bow, the six-foot staff. We have the size. We have nunchucks. We have the tonfa, and we have the kama. And then above black belt, we teach the katana also. Then as kind of warm-up weapons, we use the short sticks like the eskrima sticks and knife techniques. So, the history behind those, the kobudo weapons, of course, are from Okinawa, but if you trace the lineage back, there's a lot of Chinese influence, of course, that affected the development of weapons in Okinawa. And as far as how the katana got integrated in that, as we know, Okinawa is part of Japan as a result of the Satsuma samurai, takeover. many years ago. So with that, they brought their samurai arts, and eventually that got integrated into the culture there. So even though it's not as publicly practiced, there is a lot of katana techniques. The reason it's not publicly practiced is exactly because of the history behind it. Even though a lot of the teachers know it really well, it's still a symbol of domination, of the Japanese. So it's not... even though it's been a long time, there's still, some cultural pride there that, they don't want to highlight Japanese things necessarily of Japanese origin. And same with their jiu-jitsu. A lot of their jiu-jitsu made its way into Okinawan karate. So, but again, that's downplayed and it's not taught until you get to the higher levels. As far as the, short sticks and knives like that, Okinawans have those also. They call it the tombo for the what we call eskrima sticks here. Mm-hmm. And same with the knife. The way we practice it is, everybody says it, but I truly believe that we try to do it this way, is we truly do it as an extension of our open hand technique. So the open hand techniques lend themselves to the short sticks and the knife specifically. As far as the movements go. So I can train somebody in open hand techniques and then, put a, short stick or a knife in their hand. And it's not that they're immediately going to be, adapt to it, but, once they get comfortable with the extended range and the different purpose for it, they don't really have to do anything much different than what our open hand curriculum already requires of them. So it's a good fit, and we use those as, like I said, more of a warm-up weapon because it gets the whole body moving, hand-eye coordination, focus, and so forth. And then we move on to more of a mainstream weapon, a bigger weapon, basically, like, the bow or the sai or kama or, what have you. So, yeah, it's kind of the history behind it, and... Sensei Yamashita obviously has been a great help with that. I mean, he's definitely the master, of those things. And one of the things, he does that I picked up from him that I don't see too many other people do, a lot of people just learn the forms. And they kind of have an idea of what it's for. But, Yamashita, he puts them to use. So, you know, he'll put pads on you if he needs to actually, you know, hit you with those things. And, you know, he's a big believer. You know, you were talking about that improvisational weapons workshop. It's the same idea. You know, when you pick up a weapon, it's like Inspector Gadget. You know, he's got these parts that, you know, change on his arm and his hand. You kind of have to look at it that way. Okay, this one's for cutting. This one's a blunt weapon for crushing. You know, this one's used for this, this one for that. But you just need to focus on, you know, the specialty of that weapon rather than how what you need to do different to use it. I think the ultimate goal is that you don't have to think any differently if you pick up a weapon. You just have to realize that the range has now changed and the end result once you make contact has changed. So.
Very, very good point. I've noticed when I teach sticks, I do, if let's say I teach it to a karate art, I do make comparisons like hitting with the punya, which is the end of the stick, the short end. I'll compare it to like a hammer fist or a roof block. I'll compare it to like an upper block. Just to give them some kind of idea of what I'm doing and comparing it to their art so they have an understanding of it.
Right.
Now, since I know you do ground from, you've had judo experience, jiu-jitsu, aikido. So you do ground as well as stand-up. Which do you personally prefer? And with your curriculum, do you break those off as separate entities or do you combine the two?
Well, I'll answer the first part of that question first. As far as what I prefer, I actually like it all. I love to kick and punch, and I love to grapple, whether I'm standing up or on the ground. You know, it's just like I said, I grew up with, you know, wrestling and you know, later judo. So it really depends on the objective. You know, when I practice for myself, it's just fun. So I'm going to have just as much fun doing just ground stuff or standing up. But from a self-defense perspective, and this is how I teach, you know, my students, is you have to always understand what the objective is. So if you're, you know, a lot of times you don't know that the confrontation is upon you. You know, a fight is different. A fight, okay, both people kind of know they're going to go at it, and they line up, and then they go at it. Okay, but self-defense is something that comes on you suddenly. Maybe you get a little bit of warning or something, but, and so what's your objective? Well, you know, if you're an average citizen, hopefully your objective is to survive, not get hurt, and get out of there as quickly as possible. If you're in law enforcement, you don't always have that luxury. You're going to have to apprehend this person, which means you have to control them. If you're in the military, you can go beyond that, and maybe you need to, you know, take the person's life, you know, to stop them. So what's the end result determines what you need to do. So, you know, going into it is the strategy to take the person to the ground. Like, for example, in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I know a lot of times that's their main strategy to do that. They don't always do that, but you know, they like to do that. So from a self-defense perspective, we don't have that luxury to determine that. If there's multiple people around, if you're in law enforcement, you got stuff on your belt, you know, your taser, your pepper spray, your gun, it's probably one of the last, you know, places you want to be. But, you know, like my grandfather used to teach me, you know, with the circus in the old days. You know, we don't talk about the circus and martial arts, but martial arts had a lot of development in the circus. You know, you had the strong men, right? You had, you know, you had the two-headed lady, then you had the strong men in the circus. Mm-hmm. So the job of the strong man was to take challenges from the crowd. And you know, whoever can beat this person, you know, wins a prize, basically. Well, like all circus games, you know, you want people to win some of the time, but not too much because you go out of business. So so the strongmen, you know, learned that because they used to travel. and, you know, from place to place. So you come across people that are built differently, that have different backgrounds and so forth, and you never know who's going to be in the crowd and who's going to accept the challenge. So they realize that if they duke it out, they're hitting each other back and forth. Even if they prevail, they just hurt their customer, which wasn't good for business. So they developed, you know, they relied more on the wrestling techniques, because they realized if they can grab the person or take them to the ground, they can actually overpower them without hurting them, or at least not hurting them, you know, seriously. So that's where the term catch wrestling, you know, came about. Is basically you catch what you can. You know, there's no set rules. You get your hand on any part of the body you can and do something with it, you know, to hold them there. Mm-hmm. So I'm comfortable with both on a personal level, but it really depends, you know, on the student and what the given situation is, what kind of field they're in, and that's how I teach them. You know, and you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you could, you know, have awesome balance and, you know, be very well trained, but something happens, you fall to the ground, you got to know what to do. The objective shouldn't always be, we'll stay there and finish the job. The objective, at least for us, is to get up back on your feet, because you don't know if there's any other opponents around. But you got to know what to do on the ground. As far as what we teach, it's a big part of our curriculum. It's probably, I would say, 30 to 40% of our curriculum. So, you know, our students, you know, can go into, you know, judo matches or, you know, other type of grappling matches and participate in that if they want, or they can go into karate type of matches and just, you know, do stand-up competition, you know, just as well. And this is what I tell everybody, I guess, in a nutshell. I tell them, you know, there's really no such thing as an art, you know, martial art. You know, that's not what I teach. That's not what the teacher teaches. What we teach is a science. So, and it's the science of, there's scientific concepts. For example, in our system, you know, we have the push and pull concept. We have gravity. We have, you know, direction, and things like this. And then we have strategy. What should your strategy be? So as a teacher, I teach them those sciences that give them an advantage in a situation. And the techniques are the delivery method. So, you know, we're all built differently. So because I'm comfortable, you know, going to the ground, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to some of my students that are 90 pounds, you know, or 100 pounds. And they're going up against a, you know, guy that's, you know, built a lot bigger than them. So, you know, we teach the science, and as you get good at it, you know, then the art is really your expression, your interpretation of the science that I taught you. The way you execute the techniques and the way you put them together and the way you perform it is really your own art. So if they copy my art, they're going to become exactly like me. So what may work for me may not necessarily work for them, you know, every time. So I don't push them. From a technical perspective, they have to be exact. They have to be precise. But from an art perspective, to me, it's all different. There's really no such thing as, to me, a universal kind of a martial art. An art is very personal. This is the example I use, and not to go take up the whole time here, but I say, okay, neither one of us knows how to paint. So, you know, two of us take a painting class. And in this painting class, the teacher teaches us, you know, different kinds of canvases, different kinds of brushes, different kinds of paints, how to mix those paints, how to judge perspective when you're looking at something, you know, dimension and, you know, this and that. So let's just say we do this for 6 months or a year, and we learn, you know, all these things. And I consider all these things the science of painting. And then at the end of the class, teacher takes us out and, you know, sets us up in front of a tree and says, now paint this tree. So we both paint the tree, and then you know, the teacher comes to look at our paintings. Now, we both learned exactly the same things, but my painting will probably look different than yours. Maybe slightly different, maybe a lot different, because my perspective on life, on how I see that tree, is going to be a little bit different, or like I said, a lot different, because, you know, that's my perspective and your perspective is different. But I'm going to use the same science to represent my perspective on that canvas. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of how I think about martial arts, and that's how I teach my students.
That made a lot of sense, because that was a great analogy.
Yeah. So if we just learn to copy somebody else's painting, I don't know if we'll ever be our own artist.
Right.
And that's
right.
That's kind of what I try to promote. So learn the science, and you know, as many of us know that I've been in martial arts a long time, there's a lot of commonalities in the science. You know, there's only so many ways to move and, you know, hit and, you know, lock things up. You know, everything else is just a combination and your own interpretation of it. You know, I know, Sifu, you have a good background in some of the Filipino, you know, martial arts also. And when I first saw that, you know, what they do with the sticks and the knives, I saw a lot of similarities in kind of the way we've been practicing it. Although I had never had formal training in the, you know, in Kali and Eskrima and, you know, all those things, I could see the science behind it. And so if I could see that, you know, then I can do those things. And it may not be exactly the way they're doing it, but the science will be the same. So it makes you adaptable to other things. And it's always fun to see somebody else's interpretation of, you know, the same science. And I think that's what makes it exciting to, you know, learn from different people and, you know, see everybody else's perspective on it.
Right. And with that said, Sensei, I'll give you this open invitation. If you ever want me to come up and just share some of my Kali and do some comparisons on one of your 6 days, I'd be happy to do that for you anytime you want me to.
That sounds great. Maybe we'll have you over for a workshop.
That would be great. Then we can see what works, what similarities. Because you're right. You said something of true gospel is that you can only move so many different ways. You can only punch or kick so many different ways. It's all the same. And I've noticed that a lot of that terminology, martial science, has been used more and more frequently than it used to.
Well,
I just had a question. In today's society, is there anything, because we're trying to attract people like yourself where there's no ego, there's no, you know, you're not portraying this great martial artist. You're here to share with us, which is why, you know, one of the reasons why we asked you on was because there's just no, you're not pretentious, you're no ego about it. What is it in the martial arts that you've not stayed away from, that you don't agree with, whether it be politics or egos, anything like that?
What have I stayed away from? Well, certainly the politics.
Right.
I think you know, martial arts organizations sometimes, like all things, you know, start off for a good purpose. But there's something about, you know, whatever, whether it's in martial arts or not, there's something about an organization after they get to a certain size that loses its focus, and, you know, politics just gets into the game. And so I try to stay away from that. You know, even with Sensei Yamashita, as you can imagine, you know, he's trained some pretty good people over the years. And you know, I always talk to him about getting better organized and putting something together, but, you know, he feels the same way, is that, you know, people are going to start lining up, because as soon as you have an organization, then, you know, I want to be president, I want to be this, and, you know, recognition and this and that. I mean, you know, you brought up kind of how we met, and, you know, with the Hall of Fame thing, and I was trying to contain my smile here, because I remember that too, you know, when you told me about the Hall of Fame thing, because, you know, growing up, my idea of it was you kind of had to be like in your 80s and 90s before you're considered for something like that. So, you know, times have changed. I realize that. And some of it, of course, is for the best. But it caught me a little bit off guard, because it was like the furthest thing from my mind. You know, it's not what I was in the business for. It's not, you know, why I practice. So, because my fear is always that things become, you know, political, and that takes precedence over what you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, I was pleasantly surprised, you know, with the organization. And, you know, once I went and I saw many of the people that I knew already there. So, you know, it turned out to be a good thing, and I'm thankful for that. I think for me, that's pretty much it. I do try to stay away from, and this is probably going to be I'll probably get in trouble for this, but I try to stay away from the MMA stuff also. You know, I have my own perspective on it. I'm not necessarily against it. It's just mm-hmm. not for me, and I have no desire to, you know, train people, you know, or be trained for, you know, that type of an arena. So, you know, for me, martial arts is more of a, like I said, it's more of a personal thing. It's more of an art, you know. It's about self-improvement, and that comes first. And that takes so much time, and it's so much hard work on a regular basis. There's really not much room, you know, for an MMA type of a thing. It doesn't seem to be compatible for me. You know, having worked in law enforcement, too, it's kind of like putting a gun in somebody's hand that, you know, has had no training or has, you know, is unstable. And there's a lot of good people in MMA. I've met some of them. Some of them trained with Sensei Yamashita, actually. But a lot of those people come from classical backgrounds. So they tend to be, you know, more stable, more focused, and they just like the competition, and they're in it for that. And that's okay. But what I do see is I see a lot of other people getting into it and teachers teaching them very dangerous things without giving them any type of a, you know, without grounding them in any way. So
right.
If you have somebody that's already troubled, you know, that, you know, has no control, has a temper issue, maybe even has a criminal, you know, background, and you equip them with dangerous things like that, I think just as a teacher, you know, we have a responsibility, you know, not to do that. Ultimately, of course, we don't know, you know, what people are going to do, but, you know, we had 9/11, of course, you know, several years ago happen, and, you know, every one of those terrorists took over that plane without any guns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they had sharp objects, but I don't know how many people, you know, remember this or know this, but some of those people that were involved in that, you know, were trained in a martial arts school on a temporary basis. They just went in and, you know, they wanted to learn knife techniques, and the teachers taught them that. Of course, you know, I'm sure those teachers felt horrible after they found out, you know, who they taught and what the purpose was for. But, you know, there's a lesson in that. And that's why sometimes with the Japanese culture, they kind of want to see, they put you through the ringer, you know.
Right.
And they really push you, they really frustrate you, because they want to make sure you're stable. And it's, you know, they feel an obligation and a responsibility to teach those things. And sometimes in MMA, I think, you know, people are less careful with that. You know, as a competition, I think it's fine. You know, it's fun and all that. But, you know, I fear that it has a more of a negative impact on some people that could, you know, benefit more from a more stable type of, you know, training than otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So So I tend to, you know, shy away from those things. I'll give you another example. You know, as you can imagine, if you've been teaching for a while, you get all sorts of interesting people that walk in and want to do things and ask you stuff. So I had a guy one time that came in and, you know, asked me if, you know, what we do and, you know, if he can watch a class and stuff. So, of course, you know, we stayed and watched. And, you know, afterwards I talked to him. He said, I really like what you do. I think this is for me. And, you know, when can I start? So, you know, I always think it's best to talk to somebody before they start to see what their objective is. Because if it's different than kind of what you have in mind, you're both going to be disappointed and you're going to go away unhappy. So it's always good to be honest up front. So I said, well, you know, what's your goal? What do you want to do? We want to get in better shape, self-defense, this and that. He said, well, I want to be a bodyguard. Okay. So, you know, I'm not a bodyguard, but I have a pretty good perspective from, you know, law enforcement. And so I said, well, you know, what's your time frame? And he says, well, in 1 year's time, you know, I want to be a bodyguard. I said, okay. I said, well, what do you do now? Well, I'm in the entertainment business. I said, have you done any martial arts before? No. Have you done any law enforcement, military? You know, just trying to get a feel for the guy of where he's coming from. So he hasn't done anything. So I said, you know, this place is probably not for you. And, you know, so I gave him some information on the school that basically just focuses on bodyguards, you know, teaching bodyguards, you know, a more specialized thing. So, you know, that's the problem. If we just focus on, you know, money, if we just focus on, you know, having more students and stuff, what's going to happen? You know, is it realistic to take somebody with no previous experience in any type of, you know, combat arts, train them to be halfway decent for themselves, much less protect somebody else? It's just not going to happen, you know. So now you can make them believe that, and you can, you know, take their money and, you know, make them feel good about it. But in the end, we have a responsibility. So,
yeah,
very nice.
Yeah, I agree in the sense that it would have to be the teacher themselves to shoulder that responsibility to make sure that that student not only learns what they came to look for, but also in almost in a way to protect them from themselves, I guess, you know, in a way. Because what I've noticed a lot of over the years is that sometimes, not all, but sometimes people come into a martial arts school with a specific expectation. And number one, that expectation would be, I give you $100, you owe me these lessons. Okay, that's right. A lot of, well, you know what I mean? I'm paying you, so you teach me. And a lot of the traditional behaviors, I guess, and the traditions of being able to learn have almost fallen by the wayside. I think,
and that's the thing. That's what I think is unfortunate about the industry, is because those very same things are not necessarily unique to the martial arts. They should also be present in other things in our society, but I think in the past martial arts has been an example of those things. Mm-hmm. And you know, the bottom line is, I mean, we work with a lot of kids. And the bottom line is, that's what the parents want for their kids. You know, the self-defense is kind of a secondary thing. They want that structure. They want that stability, the respect, the focus, you know, because it's those skills and the understanding of those things that they can apply to other areas in their life, like the schoolwork, like their relationship with their parents and, you know, their peers and so forth. So, you know, we try to, I always say, you know, we're from traditional roots with a modern focus. There's a place for tradition. As long as we don't live in the past, you know, we're not bound by the traditions of other cultures in the way we practice. But there were certain formalities and things that were present in really all cultures, if you dig back, you know, far enough. that was a stabilizing force, you know, in their societies and their things. And, you know, how you practice is, you know, shouldn't be limited by tradition. But tradition does have a place. I mean, we wear uniforms. I know, you know, a lot of places are getting away from that too, and it's, you know, the shorts with the T-shirts and stuff, and that's fine. I mean, in Okinawa, they wore things that resembled diapers, you know, when the GIs landed there. It's a hot, humid island, so a gi was the last thing they wanted to put on. But like anything else, putting on a uniform adds a certain tradition to it, and it affects the behavior, you know, of the person. You don't want to be confined by that, but you want that at least as a base, you know, to build off of. You know, again, just getting back to the MMA thing, you know, what isn't MMA? I mean, really, for anybody that's been in martial arts long enough, you know, it's a funny term, you know, mixed martial arts. Is what martial arts is not mixed? You know, in what culture, you know, whether it's the, you know, Philippines, Thailand, you know, Cambodia, Okinawa, Japan, Korea, China, I mean, really, does anybody really believe that, you know, those cultures developed their martial arts and purposely excluded groundwork or weapons or, you know, anything else? They wouldn't have been able to survive, you know, but they adapted over time based on their society's need. You know, so if there was a need for a weapon, you see a heightened focus in weapons, you know, development during that time. If it was a time of peace, then you see a more sporting, you know, application of that. So I think by the time a lot of these arts made their way to the United States, the people that brought them back, you know, were exposed for the time and place, you know, where they got it from. So, you know, in the case of Okinawa, you know, it's after World War II, everything jiu-jitsu becomes do. It's about a life pursuit, you know, rather than a military pursuit. Mm-hmm. It's a very different demeanor. You know, we talk about Aikido. Aikido came from Daito Ruaiki Jiu-Jitsu, a very combat-oriented art, which is the complement jiu-jitsu for the samurai. Well, you know, Yoshiba, you know, post-World War II, you know, the emperor was basically considered, you know, God on earth, and the emperor's, you know, surrender was kind of a mind-boggling experience for a lot of people. So the people that weren't killed, you know, some of them committed suicide, you know, because they couldn't deal with that. Well, Yoshiba took that and made it, you know, more of a spiritual enlightening thing, and so he changed his Daito Ruaiki Jiu-Jitsu to be more soft, you know, flowing, and it was a big philosophical change, so that we're not going to practice to hurt somebody. We're going to, you know, just keep them off of us until they quit. You know, we're just going to keep redirecting them until they quit. So the whole philosophy changed. So if you trained with him before World War, you know, II, or shortly after, you learned a very different Aikido, you know, than you did in his later years. Genshin Funakoshi, you know, the Okinawan that brought karate to Japan. He's a Shorin-ryu practitioner from Okinawa. And so there's an account by somebody from the West that went to go train with him in his elder years in Japan. And Funakoshi was, you know, in his 70s at this time. You know, there was a language barrier, and his account was something like this. You know, when he finally got to train with him, every time Funakoshi showed him something and he repeated it, Funakoshi would say, do what I tell you, don't do what you see. You know, and he couldn't figure this out. You know, so after a while, you know, he realized what was happening is, well, Funakoshi was teaching him in his elder years, so some of the stances weren't as deep, some of the things weren't the way they needed to be because of physical limitations that he had. So if the student copied what he did without really understanding it, he's not going to be the right copy, you see.
Right.
So and a lot of this stuff made their way to the West this way, and so the different arts became associated with different kinds of things. So there were these categories of kicking and punching or grappling or weapons, when really, you know, they were all they are all integrated. So, mm-hmm. you know, you take any art and you go back far enough, and if you can find good teachers that are knowledgeable, they already have everything. You know, mm-hmm. and it's just a matter of how you want to use those things. You don't need to jump around from one thing to the other.
Exactly. Well, with that said, it kind of makes me wonder, because you said earlier that something that, you know, depending on the needs of the time, you know, the martial arts would change. It kind of makes you wonder what a lot of people think or believe we need these days. You know, because... why MMA? Why is that the, you know, why is that the big thing? You know, why do people think that this is, you know, needed, I guess, you know, I'm not putting down MMA. I don't want to see the call board bam, 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 bam. You know, why are you dissing MMA? I'm not dissing MMA. Because, you know, I respect it for the concept of being able to not be, you know, stuck on just the kicking art and stuff like that. But like you said, what martial art is not an MMA? And I guess my concern with people, especially the young people that are getting an MMA, my concern is that the young people feel that MMA sets themselves apart from other arts such as ours, Tai Chi, classical Eskrima, Kali, Karate, you know. I'm afraid, in a way, that the young people will think, well, MMA is better because blah, 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 whatever reason, right? Because of either the newness of it or the practicality of it. But, you know, your explanation of, you know, how the arts evolved and stuff make perfect sense. And I'm hoping that eventually young people do understand that what art isn't MMA.
I think that's our job, you know, as teachers, to one, get really good at what we do, and two, to just educate the public, you know, mm-hmm. because, you know, there's a lot of marketing behind MMA. And, you know, so people sometimes tend to go based on the marketing. But, you know, there's two sides to MMA. I mean, there's the spectator side and then there's the participant side. Mm-hmm. The spectator side is nothing new. You know, I mean, you know, you can go back to the gladiator days. Mm-hmm. We like to see people hurt each other.
Right.
You know, we like to see people fight. I mean, that's the reality of human nature. You know, it's not a good thing, but it's inherent in us. So I think whenever you offer people something like that, it's always going to be, you know, attractive. The audience is, of course, going to be limited. I mean, who is the main audience for these things? It's going to be a younger male audience, generally. Be a lot of, you know, women. Also, although more so these days, on the participant side, you know, why do people like it? Well, there's money in it, I mean, for one thing. And two, it's the type of training. You know, in traditional martial arts, you know, if we go back to the 70s when I started, there was a lot of stances and doing nothing for, like, months, seemed like, you know. So, you know, you can get to an MMA gym and, you know, day one you're going at it with somebody. So, you know, within 3 months you're pretty effective, you know, in hand-to-hand stuff, where in traditional martial arts it'll take you maybe years, maybe never, depending on the school you go to and what their focus is. So if it's about the fighting and how you handle yourself, it's a good way to train. But that doesn't mean that we can't use similar type of training in traditional schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in our school, at the end of each class, we have a segment called SimComs, and it's something we used to do with the cops, is simulated confrontations. You know, there we use the you know, in those days we call them the red man, you know, because all the pads were red colored. And, you know, we went at it, but... So that's the reality training. So you can have that reality training, you know, in traditional martial arts schools. And I think it's great because you go from, you know, maybe doing your basics, your forms, the application, into dynamic application. And so it's a well-rounded thing. But in the old days, I remember, you know, even street fighters that had never had martial arts training sometimes won more fights. Or somebody that had had some boxing. Well, why? Their technique was either non-existent or not very good. So what made them win? Well, that's how they practiced. They had more practice at fighting than you did. And then second, it was their attitude. So you look at something like Krav Maga. Nothing different in what they do except their mentality, their philosophy, and the training is very different. It's attack, be aggressive, and hurt your opponent. Because it's a very military-centric, you know, art. And it's fine for that if that's what your philosophy is and that's what you want to do. But I truly believe it's the training, the type of training you do, and your philosophy that makes it different. So the reason people sometimes gravitate towards MMA is because, like everything else, they want more instant gratification.
Right.
But unfortunately, they either get hurt and hurt other people, and so their martial arts career is over at a young age, where you have people in traditional arts, like my Yamashita's teacher, Sensei Nagasato, who still practices and teaches in his upper 90s now in Okinawa.
Mm.
So for me personally, that's the path I'd like to follow, you know, because it's something I can do the rest of my life potentially rather than a short-lived career, so...
Mm-hmm.
Just preferences.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Sensei,
wow,
we're
what
getting
a
little
show,
bit.
Sifu.
I know it's that
this
was
is incredible.
Cool. I just happened to look up at the clock and go, "Oh my gosh, we're getting close on time." So, Sensei, if there are any listeners out there that would like to get a hold of you and ask a little bit more about your school, Masters in Motion, did I get that correct?
Yeah, Masters in Motion. We're on Facebook at Masters in Motion. We're on Twitter. We also have a website, mastersinmotion.com. So multiple different ways to get a hold of us. And we'll be happy to work with anybody.
Awesome. So if any listeners are out there in the L.A. Burbank area, go check out Masters in Motion. Great dojo, traditional with made for modern needs. I liked how you put that, Sensei. That was really cool.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Sensei,
thank
for joining
us. Thank you so much,
us.
Sensei.
That was
anytime.
That was
a, you're welcome.
That was a wonderfully informative show, and I enjoyed it a lot. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in tonight and for all your support. So listeners, just remember, if you like this show, go ahead and join our Dynamic Dojo group page on Facebook, and it'll be updated weekly with show announcements and links to some of the news and announcements that we mentioned here on the show. And you can also...
Sifu, can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
Just in case you forget, we have a new show coming up on the Sika Network.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Let me go ahead and go into that real quick. I don't know if all of our listeners know that this show, Dynamic Dojo Radio Show, runs on a umbrella network, and the umbrella network is called the Seika Network. I founded it last year specifically to be a health, fitness, Reiki, Tai Chi, Qigong type of a thing, and I just didn't do anything with it. And just this month, I decided to put on a show, and here we are with Dynamic Dojo and Sifu Bob. So I pretty much consider both me and Sifu Bob as being the founders of the Seika Network as we know it right now. And I've been inviting people and kind of putting feelers out there to the Facebook community and the Seattle martial arts community, Twitter community, everywhere, to see if there would be people out there that would be interested in joining the network with their very own show. And we have a taker. So we've got our second show under the umbrella Seika Network, and that show is going to have its premiere this Tuesday, December, what would that be? Would that be the 8th?
That would be the 4th. No,
the 4th. Right. So this Tuesday, December 4th, and the host is going to be Lynn Yancha, LMP. She's a licensed massage massage practitioner, and the name of her show is Century Health Talk. And this particular show is going to feature subjects that deal with health, body work, fitness, and how all of that ties in together. It's a really cool concept for a show, and she'll be having lots of great guests on, body workers, doctors, martial artists, athletes, and talking about great stuff. So that particular show, Century Health Talk, will be airing this Tuesday, December 4th at 8 p.m. Pacific time. So congratulations to Lynn Yancha on her new show, and we look forward to hearing these shows starting next Tuesday. And if I remember correctly, for right now, I think Ms. Yancha is preferring that these shows occur biweekly. So every other week she'll be having these shows. So, which is great.
Cool.
Because it'll be exciting. So congratulations to her on that. Awesome. Well, with that said, everybody, thank you, listeners, and thank you again, Sensei, for joining us. And again, just another plug for the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page. And we also have our website, seikanetwork.webs.com. And that's Seika, S-E-I-K-A, network.webs.com. You'll be able to see all of our archived shows there and also upcoming announcements for other shows. So next week, however, we've got, be sure to tune in next week, because next week is our periodic rant, rave, and rap show. And that's going to be a fun show. The show's going to be based on the callers themselves. You get to call in and talk about anything. You can rant about anything you want. You can rave about anything. You can send shout outs to people. You can call in to talk about whatever you want. But like I said at the beginning of the show, save the politics and religion for some other show. That show is going to be based on you. It's going to be an open forum on steroids. It's going to be fun. So we hope that everyone tunes in for that. So anyhow, it was a great show. Thanks, everybody. And we hope to see everyone next week for the Rant, Rave, and Rap show. This is Rashida Bezzet with my cohort, Lufasio, and our special guest. Wish you a very great evening, and we'll see everyone next time. Good night, everybody.
Good night.